So good evening, dear friends and new faces. As Carmen mentioned, Kate and Michael are away this week. And so I'm delighted to share just a short reading and a personal reflection, as well as some questions for group discussion. And I was asked by Kate to share from this book by Sharon Salzberg called A Real Happiness at Work. Show the Zoom folks. And some of you may already be familiar with Sharon Salzberg. She's fairly prolific. She's the co-founder of Insight Meditation Society, along with Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldstein. And their society has its origins in the Theravada Buddhist tradition, which is sort of the oldest historical or the oldest existing school of practice historically. And although insight meditation operates from the context of Buddhist teachings, they tend to apply them in a very modern, non-sectarian way, which means that they're quite warm and practical. So I'm really pleased that Kate recommended this book. I hadn't read it. And the passage I'd like to read discusses two powerful forces that show up in the workplace. And they are praise and blame, and a possible antidote, self-compassion. So let me see if I can find my readings quickly. There we go. We cannot be compassionate towards ourselves or others when our personal sense of well-being depends on universal acceptance and praise. When we base our happiness on other people's opinions of us, we're subject to the seesaw of ambivalence, rejection, injustice, and adoration that tips this way or that, depending on who likes us and who doesn't in any given moment, or in what someone else is enjoying or enduring. In the world of praise and blame, we are constantly being thrown around by reactions to feedback from the outside world. Love for ourselves cannot reliably be dependent on the esteem of others. However, of course, we care what others think. We want to be appreciated for our strengths and thanked for our acts of kindness. All of us would rather be loved than hated. This is a natural human response. The problem lies in excessive attachment to how others value us, or not. If we look to praise as the sole confirmation of our personal integrity, we may lose sight of our own self-worth at the first hint of disapproval. It's helpful to do an honest appraisal of where personal convictions are rooted. Do they grow from confidence that we are able to do the right thing, though it may not be immensely popular? Or to step forward, speak our minds, and be ourselves, regardless of what others say? Or do we hide our true feelings and withdraw into self-judgment when outside opinions are less than friendly? This question is critical in the workplace, where disagreements are bound to happen, and sacrificing what we think to be right for the sake of unvarying approval is a sure road to suffering. By investigating our relationship to praise and blame, we free ourselves from the habit of absorbing the opinions and prejudices of others. This freedom leaves us flexible and open enough to hear criticism that is useful and true instead of rejecting it automatically. Fielding criticism with an open mind, with an eye toward what we might learn from dissent, reminds us that humility sets us free, that we will never be perfect, and that everyone is in the same fragile boat. The absence of defensiveness leads to less reactivity towards people who judge and blame us. This could not be more important than at work, where conflicts abound and professional maneuvering, the do-si-do of getting ahead, can induce a sense of danger. Watching your back, over-worrying disapproval, and obsessing over colleagues' admiration. The truth is that there might always be someone who unloads their negativity on us, and sometimes, if we're not mindful, vice versa. What matters is that we approve of ourselves. When we are at peace with our own intention and the quality of the work we're doing, then we're less likely to be thrown by rises and dips in our own reputation. A friend of mine who teaches writing learned this the hard way. An author who spent decades working alone, Michael began giving classes, meeting students, and putting himself into the world in a new, more public way when he was in his 50s. During his honeymoon period as a teacher, this is not our Michael, by the way, he found himself amazed by all the flattery coming at him from adoring students. It was a whole new kind of egotism, he admits. Before, when people praised my books or writing, they weren't really praising me, explains Michael. When I started teaching, the adulation felt more personal and more seductive. Michael's professional honeymoon came to a crashing end soon enough. Within a couple months, I had three students turn against me, viciously, he says. I didn't realize that there would be a backlash to encouraging my writing students to explore their inner demons. Michael says, chuckling, the first student blamed me for putting her back on Prozac. The second student got a crush on me and blamed me for leading her on, which is ridiculous since I'm gay. Finally, the third student, the angriest of all, stormed out of our writing group in a rage after I challenged her truthfulness in a memoir, telling me that I'd transgressed her boundaries by asking her to be so honest. She just hated me, that last one, for which I was certainly not prepared. Blame from this student caused Michael to doubt himself. Though he showed no reaction to her, he was inwardly angry, defensive, and wounded. He realized that if he wanted to continue teaching, he needed to find a middle path between praise and blame, a balanced place of confidence and humility. Some students love me, Michael understands now, and others cannot stand me. The difference is, I can live with that now. Teaching is not a popularity contest, though all of us want to be liked. This incident helped me get clear that teaching is not about me at the end of the day. It's about my students and their writing. I'm just a guide and facilitator. Psychologist Kristen Neff, author of the book Self-Compassion, makes an important distinction between self-esteem and self-compassion. She points out that self-esteem depends on measuring ourselves against whatever standard we deem the metric, undefined though that may be, such as, am I good enough, smart enough, talented enough, and so on. The difference is that self-compassion is unconditional. When self-compassion is present, our hearts open more towards ourselves when we feel down, rather than rejecting ourselves as failures. Self-esteem implies feelings of competition and can forsake us in hard times. Self-compassion is self-sustaining, present for us regardless of changing circumstances. It teaches us that when we make mistakes, we have a choice about how we treat ourselves. Rather than loading on judgment and blame, identifying yourself with the error with thoughts like, you're so stupid for sitting through that whole meeting and not uttering a word, you can use suffering to inspire a poignant remembrance of human frailty. I thought that keeping quiet would help me get along with my colleagues, but I was wrong. I was coming from a place where I knew so much less about them and about myself than I know now. Neff describes self-compassion as having three components: mindfulness, a sense of common humanity, and kindness. Mindfulness involves bringing awareness to the painful emotions that arise due to our self-judgment or difficult circumstances. We become more accepting and non-judgmental of our experience, taking a balanced approach so that feelings are neither suppressed nor exaggerated. Common humanity means getting connected to the larger human experience. Being human means being imperfect, and all people have these sorts of painful experiences. Lastly, kindness entails being warm and understanding towards ourselves when we suffer, fail, or feel inadequate, rather than ignoring our pain or flagellating ourselves with self-criticism. Self-compassion is complex, nuanced, and real, an evolving part of a living system, much more like real life, within which we operate with limited information and personal bias, all the while trying to do better. So just some personal reflections, and then I have some fun questions. Maybe they're fun. So for context, praise and blame, which figure kind of centrally in this reading, are two of the eight worldly concerns, which some of you may have heard of. They were first enumerated by Siddhartha Gautama Buddha, the historical Buddha, some 2,500 years ago, in the Anguttara Nikaya. And he lists them, I'll let the boss list them. The eight worldly conditions revolve around the world, and the world revolves around the eight worldly conditions. What eight? Gain and loss, fame and disgrace, praise and blame, pleasure and pain. Some of these are familiar to me. They've also been called the worldly winds. I think more frequently in our tradition, I've heard them as the worldly winds, and I personally really enjoy that phrasing because I imagine myself as a little sailboat sort of being rocked back and forth. I sort of have a weakness for that kind of imagery. Praise and blame definitely emerge in areas of my life. Basically, anytime I try to cook something new for Jessica, my partner, but they definitely show up in my working relationships. As some of you may know, I'm a lawyer working with survivors of family violence, and the cases I manage are complex, and my clients often arrive in my office with histories of pain, trauma, and fear, and they're looking at me to help them with difficult situations. When the outcome of the case is positive, I'm the big hero. Whether or not I deserve praise, actually, more often, it's their own resilience and courage that provides a positive outcome, and they're just sort of making me look good. On the other hand, when things don't go well, which happens often enough, it's very easy for me to get caught up in feelings of shame or obsess about things I could have done differently, even when I really did try my very best. There have been more than a few Wednesday nights, like tonight, when I plopped down on my little cushion, a little yarn ball of stress. I've noticed that one strategy I've developed to avoid blame is to work under the guidance of a sharp inner critic. I think I operate on the assumption that I need this critical voice to do well and succeed in my work. And in the absence of that positive inner dialogue, I notice that I often look to others for the kindness and affirmation that I am not willing to give myself. And so when I relate to people at work from that perspective of seeking their approval or anticipating their blame, I notice that I'm not actually meeting them authentically in those moments. I sort of listen to people through the filter of that inner critic, and I create a made-up conceptual world or little cardboard cutouts of my clients or my boss or my colleagues. And what they tell me is filtered through that voice or that narrative of my insecurities or my hopes or my expectations. And so a question that has emerged in my practice as I've noticed this arise is that once I've become aware that I'm being blown back and forth by the winds of praise or blame in my work relationships, or really any of my relationships, how can I chart a different course? Preferably one that's aligned with my vow to meet people as they really are in my life. A second question then kind of has popped up for me, or a follow-up question, which is, do I need that inner critic? How important is that inner critic to doing my job to a level where I feel okay? Do I need that inner critic to be a good partner, or even a good Buddhist? And this is why I really appreciate Sharon Salzberg and Kristen Neff's notes on the practice of self-compassion. I have sort of looked for a while to, you know, practical tips for managing the eight worldly winds. And I find that this one is really something that I can apply immediately in my life. It feels very practical. I really appreciate in particular their suggestion that through self-compassion, I can practice mindfulness, not turning away from these difficult feelings or conversations or fears, but actually confronting those feelings, but with a spirit of kindness and tenderness. And that is inclusive of that critical voice, actually greeting that critical voice and saying, oh, hello, friend, I know you're trying to help me do the best job I can. And maybe there are some different ways that we could solve this together. And as I'm being kind to myself, what makes it compassion, and I really like this, according to Kristen Neff, is a sense of interconnectedness with other people. And that's what sort of separates self-compassion from self-pity and self-esteem, which I've definitely fallen into those traps more than a few times. And her highlighting that these emerge still from a sense of comparison to others is something I found very helpful in the reading. So returning to this sense of self-compassion, I'm a human being. I'm not perfect. I can't do everything. And when I open to that, what I find is that I arrive at the ground of reality and I can investigate what I can actually do in that moment. So I'm actually arriving in reality, a reality that is inclusive of the other person and also my own needs, concerns, and health. And when I thought of this, I thought, oh, that sounds like turning the light of compassion inward to illuminate the self. And it felt a little familiar. And really, it does feel like if I take that on, I have a more accurate picture of what is actually going on in my life and in these work relationships. In this regard, I strongly feel that my practice of Zazen is the basis for a practice of self-compassion. I mean, I'm a pretty big fan of Zazen, so I have to work it in somewhere, but I really do feel that's true. Reading Kristen Neff's comments on self-compassion made me think of something that the famous 20th century Zen teacher Kodo Sawaki wrote. We often wonder who here is really better, but aren't we all made out of the same lump of clay? Everyone should sit firmly anchored in the place where there is no better or worse. Your whole life long, you're completely out of your mind because you think it's obvious that there is a you and the others. You put on an act to stand out in a crowd, but in reality, there's neither you nor the others. When you die, you'll understand. Buddha Dharma means seamlessness. What seam runs between you and me? Sooner or later, we all end up acting as if a seam separates friend and foe. When we get too used to this, we believe that this seam really exists. Poor and rich, important and unimportant, none of that exists. It's only glitter on the waves. What better way to keep my little sailboat safe in heavy winds than to sit firmly in the place where there is no better and worse, even if it's just for 30 minutes on a Wednesday night. This practice really inspires me to step outside of my typical stories and engage with myself as if I was a good, wise friend. What would I say to a good friend? This doesn't have to be verbal. In a talk a little while ago, Kate mentioned the power of self-touch, and that's something that has kind of stayed with me. And I've tried it on at work. In a stressful court proceeding, I will sometimes give myself a little hand rub, and I find that can actually steady me in challenging situations. I actually noticed a difference in the evidence I've been able to obtain from cross-examination in trials, now that I build in little self-compassion breaks during long periods of cross-examination. So taking a breath, taking a drink of water, or touching my hands together gently seems to help me just take my time and be a little bit more patient with the person I'm speaking to. And in dispute resolution work, sometimes after taking a moment to breathe and be kind to myself, I've actually found the words to articulate solutions that wouldn't have come to me otherwise. And my feeling is that in those moments, by taking a moment to return my attention to my own physical sensations and my mental state, I sometimes feel I'm able to listen more openly to the person across from me. I find this surprising because I really have believed for most of my professional career, which means it's not been that long, but it's been a while, that negative critic is essential to performing at the level that I feel I should be at. And that doesn't necessarily seem to be the case. And actually, strangely enough, I think 2 weeks ago, Kristen Neff was on the Hidden Brain podcast with Shankar Vedantam. It's a fabulous little podcast on applied psychology. And she speaks about her book, Self-Compassion, but she also makes reference to a really interesting study at UC Berkeley. So, and I felt I would mention it because it really does, really was a bit of a slap in the face for me. So this study involved a vocabulary test for students at UC Berkeley. So it's this vocabulary test that basically was impossible to succeed at. For Trekkies, it was like the Kobayashi Maru. It's like the test that everyone is going to fail. So they divided these three students, these students into three groups. One group was given a self-esteem boost. So, oh, you're so smart. Look, you made it to UC Berkeley. This will be no trouble for you. The second group was the control, and I guess nothing was done for them, and that's a little sad. And the third group was told to be self-compassionate. So, hey, you know, everyone fails now and then. Try to be kind to yourself. Take time to look after your well-being. And so the students took the test, and of course they all failed. And then they were told to go and study and take it a second time. And what they found was that the students that were told to be self-compassionate actually studied longer and did better on that second exam than the students, than the control group, or the students that were told, you know, oh, you're hot stuff. So that really stopped me in my tracks when I heard that. I have sort of made excuses for that critical voice for so long, thinking, well, at least this gets me, you know, better results for my work. And self-compassion feels like, you know, silver medal, second best. And maybe that's not true. I'm not sure. I mean, one study won't make up my mind entirely, but what I'd like to do is reflect on that and investigate that in my own life during this practice period and maybe sometime after. And maybe I'll let you all know how that goes.